Velkommen til Kjemperådet. Vi har fått inn et kjempeproblem her. Jeg leser. Jeg på ferie med familien. Det gøy, bortsett fra at jeg har gips på begge beina. Kan ikke bade eller dra noe sted. Jeg føler meg veldig begrenset. Hilsen begrenset far.
Begrenset far trenger ubegrensethet.
Yes. Ja. Kanskje ubegrenset data fra 399 med familierabatt hos Telenor.
Ja, det løser jo alt, bortsett fra det med badingen da. Se nye mobilabonnement på Telenor.no.
Yes!
Neste gjest en amerikaner, og det jo ikke en hvilken som helst amerikaner, da. Fader heller, det jo en av mine absolutte yndlingsforfattere. Så jeg egentlig litt spent. Don Winslow heter han, han vel fra både, han egentlig vokst opp på østkysten, så har han bodd mye i San Diego og Kalifornien, vært surfer, vært privatetterforsker og turguide i Afrika, masse forskjellig. Men så har han skrevet da bøker, og over alle de andre bøkene hans, i mine øyne, så står den trilogien han skrev om meksikanske narkotikakarteller. The Power of the Dog, The Cartel og The Border, det er kommet for noen år siden, og det er noe av det beste jeg har lest, altså inkludert alle bøker jeg har lest. Altså, har du ikke noen lest i sommer, eller lurer på hva du skal ta med deg til syden eller fjellet eller bare hjemme, kjøp den kartelltrilogien til Don Winslow. Den den er helt rå, ettersett. Og nå har han kommet med en ny bok som heter City on Fire, den første i en trilogi, og derfor er han nå ute liksom, og gjør en turné. Da skal jeg snakke med ham, tror jeg, direkte fra der Berlin. I hvert fall Tyskland. Og det som er nå, da, er jo at jeg gjorde research til dette den podcasten her, da så jeg at han sier at han skal gi seg som forfatter, altså han skal slutte, eller han har nærmest sluttet å skrive bøker. Det er en veldig dårlig nyhet da, men har en veldig god grunn nå da, men det kan jo høre med han om når han nå logger seg på. Jeg må bare si at altså, hvis dere synes jeg er dårlig engelsk, dårlig uttales videre, jeg ber om tilgivelse for det. Det er så bra jeg snakker cirka, og blir dere kan engelsk, så kan dere hoppe til vente til neste podcast, for den er ikke på engelsk. Don Winslow altså, en av Amerikas, og dette er ikke bare noe jeg finner på, største krimforfattere noensinne, kommer her.
Hello.
Hello, Don.
How are you?
I'm fine, how are you?
You know, today I'm kind of sad and angry.
Because of that?
Yeah. On the scale of things, I'm fine. Thanks for asking. But it's a tough day, you know.
Because of the shootings, right?
Yes, of course. Yeah.
So you're in Berlin now, is that right?
No, I'm in Hamburg.
In Hamburg, okay. So you just heard about
Germany.
It? Or,
last night, last night. Yeah. I called home to speak with my wife, and she told me about it, and then sort of up most of the night about it, you know, so, yeah. But I won't let it affect our interview.
I mean, you know, this is about the people I'm talking to, then if they feel that way, we have to, you know, that's the way they feel. And I don't know how you react to that kind of news, but is there a numbness? Do you have a numbness to this? Is, you know, there's been several shootings.
There've been so many shootings, and I wouldn't describe it as a numbness exactly. I'd describe it as just, I don't know what I'm feeling today. I'm so angry and frustrated because this happens over and over and over again, and we don't do anything about it, and we mumble the same cliches, and then our politicians do nothing. So it's infuriating and frustrating, and of course, very, very sad, you know.
What got me today was seeing the faces of the, I don't know, relatives or whatever, waiting behind the fences, waiting for news, just, you know, getting a glimpse of how they might feel.
It's, can you imagine? I mean, as a parent, you know, I mean, my kid is an adult now, you know, but I can't even fathom it, you know.
Okay, we'll get back to, you know, a little talk about what you want to do about, you know, the state of things later.
Yeah.
But I have, you know, a kind of a set frame to this. So if you don't mind, I'll start with that now.
You got it.
Are you ready?
I am ready.
First of all, I think it's called a roll call. Don Winslow, is here present? You can say yes.
Oh, yes. Hi.
Yeah, yeah. And Kira's
present here.
Yeah. Good. Yeah. Me too. All right, Dan, you will talk a little bit about how you feel today, but the reason you're in Hamburg and the reason I'm talking to you now is because of this book, City on Fire, which is your latest, which I just finished. Thank you very much again for a great, great book and a great read.
Thank you.
That's right, you're promoting it right now. Is that what you're doing?
Yes. I'm in Germany promoting the book. It just came out here, so I'm in Hamburg right now, and I think Berlin tomorrow, and Leipzig, and Vienna, and a whole bunch of places. So yeah.
So how is it? You know, travel the world and talk about your book.
You know, listen. I owe readers every material thing I have in the world. You know, is due to readers and booksellers, and so it's nice to get out and see people in person, particularly after the last couple of years. Yeah. You know, we haven't been doing that sort of thing, and to say thank you. So it's good. You know, it's grueling. I think this is my 25th city in 24 days or something like that. Whoa. But it's good to get out and see folks and thank them.
You're not bored by it? In the same questions over and over again?
No. Listen, you know, of course, when you write a book, there are certain questions that are natural.
Yeah.
You know, that are simply going to be asked because of the subject of the book or the nature of the book or whatever. And so I try to give fresh answers, but still truthful and accurate, you know, and they might be the same, but it doesn't really matter.
Right. I'll probably be repeating a few of those questions right now, I guess.
Well, we'll find out.
Yeah, I guess this.
And it's fine if you do, you know, because they are the natural questions, right. You know.
So let's start with the obvious. And why did you? This is a book about. It just came out in Norway too. Just to mention that.
Okay.
It's about a guy caught up in a war between the Irish and Italian organized crime families in the 80s. And this guy rises to power almost, you know, against his own will. I guess we can say, right? Danny, the main character. Why did you want to write it?
I wrote the first sentence of this book 27 years ago.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Because I had this idea, having read the Iliad and other Greek and Roman classics, I wondered if I could merge them with my beloved crime genre. Now, obviously, it took me a few decades to accomplish that. I was doing other things, you know, I wrote several sort of big novels about drug trafficking and other things. But finally came back to this. It was sort of a homecoming. This is the first book that I've set in my hometown.
And not in the time you grew up, though. You were...
No.
You're older.
I was older by the time this book happened, yeah.
So why the 80s then?
A couple of reasons. One, you know, this is the first volume of a trilogy. And so, unlike my other trilogy, this one was planned. I intended from the beginning to write three books about it. And so I could sort of forecast, you know, where did I want Danny to be in book two and book three? What was happening in American crime in those years? And so the 1980s made sense. The other reason is that the 80s were when organized crime in America really went into a steep decline.
Oh.
You know, and it's interesting to me to write about subcultures that are in decline, that are on their way down. You would think, you know, it's kind of counterintuitive. You would think that the more there is to fight over, the more vicious the fighting is. The opposite is true, actually. The less there is to fight over, the more vicious the fighting is.
Okay.
You know, because people are fighting for the last scraps on the table.
So was that what happened? You know, they got less things to
fight
for. Okay.
Yeah. To use an analogy, I mean, the rats are fighting over a smaller and smaller hunk of cheese, and that makes it all the more vicious.
How is it today? I mean, do you have organized like Irish crime families or
not really? No. No, you know, the mafia, the Italian-American, Sicilian-American mafia still exists, but it's nowhere near the strength that it used to have. You know, okay. it's a shadow of what it used to be.
So what do they do? You know, reminisce about the old days, good old days, or?
Well, most of them are dead or, in prison. But yeah, I think that there's some nostalgia about the days when they had real power and real influence. But, you know, there are fewer and fewer of those guys around.
So who's calling the, you know, shots now in organized crime in America?
You know, listen, I mean, organized crime has shifted. You know, the Mexican cartels, the Latin American cartels are, you know, on the way to controlling the drug market. There still are some old mafiosi around, maybe a little bit in the construction trades and some other, you know, labor racketeering. But really, it's changed a lot.
So there's not like one big mafia ruling?
No, not anymore. Not anymore. You know, we went through a phase where sort of Russian mobsters were very powerful, and that's on the wane. You know, but I would say really, you know, the major money is in drugs, and that is, you know, predominantly but not exclusively a Latin American thing.
Okay. Right. So this is sort of the last few days of the... good old European, I guess you can say, mafias, right?
I think that's fair, yeah.
When I read about organized crime like this, or watch the films or series or whatever, I'm both, you know, relieved and envious that I'm not part of it, right? Have you the same feeling?
Yeah, sure. You know, listen, I grew up around it. You know, it was all over the place. It was just part of the culture. You took it for granted. It has some attractions. Look, let's face it. You know, when we kind of, you know, average folks have problems, we have to go through, you know, often complicated solutions. Yeah. I think the fantasy or the attraction about OC, organized crime, you know, is that they cut through those knots, you know, and just create their own solutions to problems. You know, Marlon Brando sits there with a cat on his lap and kind of a make it thus kind of a world, you know, Tony Soprano somewhat less so. And I think that there's an attraction to that. When you look, though, at what the reality of that life is, you know, typically it's pretty sad and usually it ends badly.
Right. Yeah, because, you know, based on The Godfather and, like you said, Sopranos, all those films and I guess a lot of books too, one of the things I'm most envious about is the, you know, the dinners, you know, the big family dinners.
Yeah.
With the wine and the mother, you know, having control and the cursing, the social aspect of it.
But, I've been to those dinners.
You've been to them?
They're pretty good.
They are.
They are. You can't beat the food, you know, and it never stops. But, you know, if that were all there were to it, you know, fair enough, but it's not, you know.
So why did you go to those dinners? Were they friends of yours that invited you?
Oh, yeah. I grew up with these people,
So they said, Don, come over. We're having...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I'm sorry, I keep interrupting you. I'm sorry.
No, this is the team's thing. Was that the Italian kind of guy or guys or Irish?
Yeah, the Italian guys. Yeah, okay. Yeah. You don't want to go in for big Irish cooking, you know. No insult to anybody, but, you know, if you have your choice, I'd go with the Italian dinner. But, you know, they used to barricade the blocks, the ends of the streets.
You're right.
And then bring out like clean new trash cans and make huge, huge vats of pasta and stuff and just hold impromptu street parties, you know, that you because you lived on the block, even though we were an Italian, you'd be invited to, and they were fantastic.
What did you think? Did you think, oh boy, I want to be a part of this too when I grow up? I want to be a part of this community? No?
No. I guess I was just smart enough to see the other side, right. You know, to see around the corners. I grew up in a pretty legit family. You know, my old man was pretty straight-laced. My mom was a librarian. And so even though you knew these folks and it was part of the culture, you know, I was taught pretty differently.
But it's also, it could have been like Danny in the book, you know, can't you just come in and do us one favor? That's always how it is in films anyway. Do this one favor for us and then you get sucked into it.
Listen, I did a few odd jobs.
Oh, you did?
Know, yeah, I delivered some alcohol on, you know, on days when it was illegal. I had a job of going to the back of the package store, the liquor store, and loading up with their orders and taking it out to their customers when I was a kid. It was, you know, a job. But that was about the extent, you know.
You didn't get to whack a guy or something like that, that kind of job.
Let me go on the record very clearly. I have never whacked a guy.
Are you sure?
Yeah, absolutely sure. I think I would have remembered.
Yeah, probably. It's not too late, though.
Yeah, it is actually too late. Yeah, okay.
No, my point is, in this book, in your book, Danny, the main character, he doesn't seem so, you know, the people they don't, he gets very lonely at the end, is my point, even mm-hmm. though it's supposed to be a tight-knit community.
I think at the end of the day, it's a very lonely community.
Yeah.
You know, listen, there's a lot of romanticization. Is that yes. a word?
Should be.
Okay. Should be. About it, you know, and I think that a lot of people get in it and stay in it because of that sort of brotherhood and that camaraderie mm-hmm. and, you know, everything you see, which is actually quite real. But at the end of the day, it usually ends up you're in a cell alone.
Yeah.
You know, and the reality is, and we're talking about the decline of the mob in the 1980s, you know, is that most people, almost everybody turned rat.
Oh, okay.
You know, they turned on each other. The only guy who didn't was John Gotti, and that's because he had no one to rat on. You can't rat down. You have to rat across or up, right. And there, you know, there was nobody. So the reality of this life is that these guys really are very lonely, and despite all of the camaraderie and the so-called code and all of that, at the end of the day, they know they're on their own.
Yeah, which doesn't seem so enviable anyway. After all,
no.
Okay, so let's say, you know, if you've seen Godfather too many times, read this book a few times too, sort of get things balanced. Although, actually, in The Godfather, Michael's quite lonely at the end too, isn't he? But you tend to forget
that. Yeah, at the very end of that film, there's that great shot, you know, of him just sitting there.
Yeah.
You know, the end of Godfather 1, you know, it's the door slamming in Diane Keaton's face. Now, Godfather 1 is a retelling of Shakespeare's Henry the Fourth.
Right.
It's exactly the same plot. And, you know, Diane Keaton makes sort of an odd Falstaff, I'll agree, but it's exactly the same story. But, you know, listen, Godfather, the two Godfathers, you know, are one of the greatest American films ever. But I would not say a film that is very realistic about the mafia, and certainly not the, you know, the more contemporary mafia.
Right. No. Okay, but listen, you said, I just saw this, after you finished this trilogy, which is, you know, two more books, you're retiring as a writer.
Yeah.
Is that right?
That's correct.
I mean, really?
Yeah, really. Yeah.
Yeah.
Actually, I have finished those two books.
Oh, so you have, in a way, already retired?
Yes.
You've written your last sentence?
Yes.
Do you mean this?
Yeah.
Tell us why.
Well, I think that we're at a kind of an existential point in democracy in the United States and perhaps the world. I think that whatever talents I have, whatever energy I have is at this point in time better used in that fight against what I would consider to be, you know, neo-fascism. And so I've decided to, you know, to this is a maybe romantic way of putting it, but to set down the pen and pick up the rhetorical sword.
Yeah. Enter the fight, sort of.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I've been in it for a while, you know.
Yeah, on Twitter, not at least.
Yeah, on Twitter, yeah. For the past, you know, about 5 or 6 years, I guess. Everything around COVID seems a blur, you know. My chronology, like everybody else's, I think, is a little murky.
But since Trump, right?
Since Trump. Yep. Yeah, well, before Trump, you know. Okay. I took out an ad in the Washington Post a number of years ago advocating an end to the war on drugs. Because I felt if I didn't kind of do something proactive, I was just another guy making money off dope, you know?
Yeah, okay.
But especially since Trump,
So you see, I mean, so you've been sitting around writing and being an activist sort of at the same time, and now you decided, no, it's not enough. I have to do this full time, right?
Yeah, there's only so much time and so much energy to do something well, you know. I'd like to think otherwise. You know, you'd like to think you could do everything well at the same time. I don't know that that's the truth. And I think that, you know, we are fast going into this very critical few years that if we don't get it right, we might not ever get a chance to set it right, you know. It's not just a sort of a fight, you know, the typical sort of tug of war between conservatism and liberalism. I think it's more than that. And so, I think I need to devote myself to that.
What are you going to do exactly?
Well, I'll be continuing doing the same thing I've been doing, being active on Twitter. My partner, Shane Salerno, and I do these videos that have had something like 250 million views, which is kind of crazy. We're trying to organize what we call a digital army of people to be out there doing the same sort of thing, to form kind of a rapid response team when these scurrilous lies come out, to be able to respond to them very quickly. Encouraging people to come up with creative ways to get into this fight. Encourage people to donate to candidates if they have the resources, and certainly to vote and to help get the vote out. So, and then, you know, a lot of it's responsive, because I don't know what the news is going to be, you know, and we're responding to that.
Yeah, so you're trying to, you know, give your answer to some things that the Trump Republicans are saying or doing, or you want to get your side of the story out there as quickly as possible.
Yeah, yeah. And I'd almost object to the phrase side of the story, right, no offense. Yeah, yeah. You know,
the truth, I think that the truth.
The truth. The truth. I mean reality. And to say it in some very, very plain, simple, and you know, sometimes tough ways.
You know, sitting in Norway reading about it, you will get the news. But like when you talk now, it seems like you're talking about an army, the fight, you know, weapons, stuff like that.
I know.
Is there a risk that there actually could be some kind of, you know, civil war?
I don't see that, simply because the geography is more complex than what would allow for that.
But a modern version of it somehow, you know, it fights.
Somehow. Actually, well, listen, we're certainly in, you know, what people call the culture war.
Yeah.
We saw it get violent on January 6th. You know, so I wouldn't say civil war, but I think that there's a danger of further violence and all of that. But look, you know, if everybody who could vote voted, and if every vote counted, we would win. By the way, you know, just about every time. Mm-hmm. And so really, this is a fight for democracy, you know?
Yeah. Getting the truth out there, sort of. But isn't there, you know, imagine the way it works out, that the Democrats are pushing the message, reaching out to other Democrats, and the Republicans to their side, and you don't get the other, you don't get the, you know, in a way, the enemy to read your message.
Yeah, that could be. But listen, I mean, there are two issues around that, I think. One is that when we're getting the message out, we're motivating people for action, And I'm not talking about violence. I'm talking about voting, and I'm talking about supporting candidates and, you know, getting the word out. I also think, though, that there's a critical number of sort of undecided people, yeah, you know, who are on the fence on these issues. And part of this, of course, is to reach them.
Mm-hmm. Do you, I mean, in a way, maybe during the pandemic, it was quite clear to a lot of us people that work with, you know, culture and literature or music or art or whatever. Oh, it's great. We always need art. But I think there's a nagging feeling that, oh, maybe we should do something more actually useful, you know? Is that a feeling you've had for some time now?
Yeah, yeah. About myself.
Yes.
Listen, I would never, you know, say that an artist has any responsibility other than to do art well.
Okay.
You know, I mean, I always think that the one responsibility a writer has is to write well. I think beyond that, it's a personal decision. So I'm not condemning or criticizing anybody who doesn't do this. You know, it's none of my business. But for me personally, you know, I think I have a certain skill set. I think part of that skill set is to say things succinctly and plainly.
Yeah.
Sometimes viciously, but that's what it requires. And so, I think this is what I should be doing.
So you're not, you know, telling all fellow authors and writers in the world, put down your pen and pick up the sword.
I'm not.
No,
I'm not. That's, you know, that's up to the individual. You know, I'm not sort of thinking that I'm standing on some sort of mountain talking down to people. You know, all I'm saying is that for myself at this point in time, this is what I need to be doing.
You've changed your career quite a few times before you became a writer.
Mm-hmm.
Is this, you know, is a part of this you get being bored of being a writer and want to do something?
No.
Not at all?
No. Listen, I've wanted to be a writer my whole life. You know, you refer correctly to the number of careers I had. You know, I needed to make a living. You know, I needed to pay rent and eat and feed my family. Nobody stamps your passport to become a writer. And it took a number of decades, you know, for me to support myself. So this is the gig that I've wanted since I was a kid. It's been great to me. You know, I've had a much bigger career than I ever dreamed of. It's been so good to me. No, it's not my being bored being a writer. I love being a writer. But you can't choose the times that you live in.
How did it feel to put, you know, the last punctuation?
It was tough. It was tough, you know, because... I could see it coming.
Yeah.
You know, as I headed around the bend of, you know, the last thing about Danny, the protagonist of this book, and knowing that I was writing toward not only an end of his story, but an end of mine, it was kind of emotional. You know, it was a feeling like, you know, I don't know if you've had this experience of like being at the beach at sunset and it's extraordinarily beautiful, but ephemeral. And you know, the sky gets red and orange and pink, and then it starts getting darker, you know, and you know that there's nothing that you can do to make it last. You know, that there's going to be that sliver of a sun going over the horizon of the ocean, and then that's it. And so writing the last few chapters of this last book was sort of like being in that sunset, you know, knowing that you're headed for that moment where that sliver of sun slips over the ocean, and there you are.
Yeah, beautiful and sad.
Yeah, listen, there's some sorrow attached to this decision, of course, you know, but again, if you balance that against participating in a fight for the survival of our democracy, there's no discussion to be had. You know, my career is trivial compared to that.
When you win that fight, can you please come back to writing?
I don't know. I don't think so. we'll see. Never say never, you know, but I don't want to just say, oh, I'm suspending my career. You know, I think if you're gonna dive into something, you dive into it. You know, there's a famous and true saying in surfing that you can't outrun a wave. You can't. You can't. It's much faster and more powerful than you. The only way to deal with it is to dive into it. And you dive into the deep part of it. You don't dive into the shallow part of it. And so this is me diving into the deep part of that wave.
I have another part of this talk that I'm going to jump into right now. If you just, are you with me on that?
Sure.
I have this book here that all my guests are sort of helping out, filling out. It's from my childhood, actually in the 80s. I guess okay. I'm about the same, a little younger than Danny in your book. So we, yep. I can just read out what it says and you'll fill out, all right?
All right.
Name, your full name.
Donald Lewis Winslow.
Right. But just Don, you call yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah, Don.
I call Don. Yeah, I go by Don Winslow. Yeah.
Address, where do you live?
I'm not giving you that.
But the town, you can say the town.
No. Do you know why?
No.
Because I get a lot of threats.
Oh, do you? Okay, because of the fight.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So I'm not just being snarky with you.
All right.
It's not information I give out. East Coast, West Coast? I live half the year on the West Coast and half the year on the East Coast.
Okay, that's good enough.
Fair enough.
That's, yeah. Your birthday, when is it?
Halloween.
Yeah. So
October 31st.
Yeah.
1953.
Right. So you have a big year coming up next year?
Yeah.
Do you, you know, feel something towards that?
Of course.
Yeah. So 17.
Yeah, look, man, I always think I'm 14 and then I walk past a mirror and I realize I'm not. Yeah. Or I see a photograph. Who is that old guy? You know, it's shocking every time.
You know, that's not what you think when you are 14 yourself and look at older people. You think they are fully comfortable with their age, and of course they're old. And when you get older, you realize they too felt, you know, 14 when they got old.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know, I think I'm in the best shape of my life. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah, I'm in great shape. I'm in great condition. You know, I can do most of what I used to do, but maybe not as well. Mm-hmm. You know, or it takes more time to recover from it. But yeah.
So, but you're not. It's not like an existential crisis. You're not buying yourself a
No. Nothing like that.
You're not retiring either. You're not, you know, planning on sitting on your couch.
Ass playing.
Yeah.
My couch, you know. No, I'm not taking up golf. Yeah. I'm not sitting on my couch. I'm not playing shuffleboard. You know, not taking up crocheting, any of that. I intend to stay on Twitter and be verbally violent and fight this thing out. Yeah.
Color of hair is the next question here.
What hair? Flesh.
Yeah.
Silver with a little black thrown in, maybe. Yeah.
So when you were young, what was it? Black?
Brown. Yeah, brown. Okay. Actually, yeah, yeah.
Color of your eyes?
Brown.
Brown. Okay. Sisters or brothers?
One older sister.
Still alive?
Yes.
And good friends? With her?
Yeah. Also a novelist, by the way.
Oh, is she?
Written, I think, 44 published romance novels.
Oh, man.
Two kids in our family, both novelists. Christine Rolofsson.
Oh, what's that, the last name?
Her married name, Rolofsson. Yeah. R-O-L-O-F-S-O-N.
Rolofsson? Sounds Norwegian or Swedish, maybe.
German, I think.
Is it?
Okay. My wife is Swedish, actually.
Is she?
Yeah, oh. Well, ethnically, her grandparents came over from Sweden.
Was there ever a Swedish mafia in the United States?
Not that I'm aware of. If they did, they just went around vacuuming places.
Right. Very small area.
Making them break into your house and clean it. You know?
That would be actually a very good idea.
Or leave Lutfisk or something. Or
Yeah, Lutfisk is Norwegian, so that, don't get those two mixed up.
It's dreadful, whatever it is. It's not my fave.
And me neither. Okay, yeah. School. Which school did you go to as a kid?
Greenwood Elementary.
In Providence? Which is the town?
Near Providence, Warwick.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Which is on the East Coast, of course, of the United States.
Yeah.
Which was the most fun, what did you like the best in school? I mean, math or English?
History.
Or? History.
History, yeah. Yeah. I flunked about everything else, actually.
Why did you like history?
I still love history. It's just intriguing to me. I love learning about the past and yeah. It's still mostly what I read.
But you haven't written any like very historical novels yet.
Not yet.
Not yet. Oh, there's an opening there.
No, I haven't. Yeah.
Yeah.
We'll see.
What was the subject you liked the least?
Oh, math.
Math. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Algebra.
Still hate it.
I still can't. Still hate it. Can't do it. Won't do it. Yeah.
Okay, now we move.
There's going to be no math in this quiz, is there? Because
no.
You're not going to ask me math questions next.
I'm not going to ask anything more about math at all.
Okay, all right, then we can continue.
Good. My interest is in the next question here, and then we talk about the interest now. You know, apart from being on Twitter, what are your interests in life? What do you like to do?
There's so many. You know, the problem with life is not that there's not enough to do. There's too much to do. Mm-hmm. You know, too many books to read. I love reading, you know. I think most writers do. I still love to surf.
You do?
Yeah. I'm not very good at it anymore, and I don't do it as much as I used to, but I'm still out there, yeah. I love to take hikes.
And
to walk.
Where? In the mountains or in forests? Or?
It depends on where we are. If we're living on the West Coast, we live up in what they call mountains. I would call them hills, you know?
Yeah.
But my wife and I typically walk, you know, 4 to 6 miles a day, you know, up and then obviously back down a hill. When I'm in the East Coast, we live near the beach, obviously. And so we walk, you know, usually 5 miles a day on the beach. So that's what I like to do.
So you don't sit on your computer like 24/7 and write and read and write and read, and you spend some, you get outdoors. Yeah,
I do. You know, I do. You know, my work day typically starts around 5:30 in the morning.
Oh, that's
and then
really?
And then I take a break around 9:30 and my wife and I go out walking. That's if we're on the West Coast, and then I go back to work. If we're on the East Coast, start work at the same time, but then I work through until about 3 in the afternoon, and then I'm in the ocean until sunset.
Surfing.
Sometimes surfing, sometimes body surfing, sometimes swimming, sometimes just walking.
So that's why how you keep in shape, those walks and those hours in the ocean.
Yeah, and I do like 3 days a week. I have a little gym in the office and I work out there.
Okay. Yeah. I read your book, Gentleman's Hour.
Uh-huh.
Which is about, I guess, when you're a surfer, that's San Diego, right?
Yeah.
A group of guys hanging out in the water waiting for, you know, guys sort of veterans in the surfing.
Yeah.
Are you part of those group, some kind of a group like that, or?
Not really. Anymore, I'm more sort of a lone wolf.
Okay.
I kind of tend to avoid the crowds. I think that surfing's in some ways become a victim of its own popularity. And so the water can get pretty crowded, And listen, I've had my day. Do you know what I mean? And so I kind of tend to find the empty water, leave the space to other people who haven't had their turn yet. Yeah. And I'll just find a quieter spot, do my stuff.
Okay, well, next question here is very open.
What are you laughing at? What?
I'm just seeing that, you know, there's a picture of you, just that guy, you know, all alone with a young, cool kids having fun, you know. It's something, nice and little bit sad.
I like to see the young kids having a good time, you know, but they don't need some old guy hanging around telling stories, you know, that they're not interested in and, you know, getting in their way. I still have a few surfing friends. Sometimes I'll go out with, you know, but for the most part, yeah, I do it alone.
Do you ever hang out with the guys you got invited to those Italian dinners when you were young? Do you ever see those again?
Every once in a while. I don't think, you know, the big dinners are kind of a thing anymore. But, you know, I was just in Rhode Island doing book signings and stuff. And some of those guys were around or came up, you know, or I'll see them in bars or restaurants sometimes. Sure.
Okay. The next question is very open, as I said. It's this is translated from Norwegian, of course. I like the most. And you answer.
Jazz.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
What kind? You mean to play or listen to?
Listen to. I do play saxophone, but I'm really bad at it. And I'll only play alone, like literally inside of a closet, you know, the door shut. Yeah. Because, you know, I'm not inflicting that on any unsuspecting person, you know, including my spouse. I listen to mostly like 1950s, early 1960s jazz. The guys you would expect, you know, Miles Davis, Coltrane, Charlie Parker, but also some maybe slightly lesser known people, Sonny Stitt, Clifford Brown, Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers, Lee Morgan. I could go on and on, but I'm probably boring you to tears, so I'll stop.
No, I'm just thinking about, you know, Harry Bosch, Michael Connelly, protagonist. Is it's kind of the same taste in music as you have?
I think so. Yeah.
Sounds like it.
Yeah. Michael Connelly's such a great guy, by the way.
Do you know him?
Yeah, a little bit, you know. Yeah. Good man.
Do you hang out with other famous writers a lot?
No, because, you know, the reality of it is that most writers, you know, we spend, of course, 90% of our time alone.
Yeah.
With people who don't actually exist, you know, so rarely, you know, but sometimes, you know, you go to these writers conferences,
yeah.
And, you know, you'll see each other, but it's not very common. But yeah, I've done like panels with Connelly and some of those other folks, you know.
You don't hang out in jazz dives, you know, sipping whiskey, listen to old
classics. I don't think that world exists anymore.
Really?
Know? Yeah. You know, listen, I was a private eye and I was a private investigator for a while. And, you know, it never, ever once happened, you know, that I was sitting in my office and a long-legged blonde walked in,
what?
You know, while a trumpet played. Unless it was my wife and I had, you know, jazz playing in the background. But
yeah. What kind of cases
I'd love to do that. I would love to hang out in some jazz club, you know, with, I don't know, Pelicanos or, you know, Baldacci or somebody like that, and, you know, listen to jazz. But it's few and far between.
Right. But what kind of cases did you do the most when you were a private investigator?
Boy, it depends on what phase of my career you were talking about. You know, early on when I was like a kid, I was just a street op in New York City doing low-level cases, you know, in Times Square and Hell's Kitchen. Later on in life in California, I was doing higher level work, mostly, you know, interviewing witnesses, getting people ready for trial, working with lawyers. And so those were arson cases, homicide cases, insurance fraud, God, you name it, you know. I did not do what they call matrimonial work.
You didn't?
Never. No, I never had to do that, thank God.
No spying on unloyal.
No.
No, okay.
No tracking the cheating spouses or, you know, peeking through motel windows or anything like that.
Do you miss your PI days? Ever?
Yeah, a little bit. Sometimes there's a little. Listen, you know, there's a lot about it I don't miss. You know, when I was in New York, it was down and dirty and it was dangerous. And, you know, and later on, I mean, for a while, I caught like a year and a half of child sex abuse cases, which I certainly don't miss. But the work was always interesting. It was with very smart people, you know. And interesting people and, you know, and cops and lawyers and judges and of course criminals, you know. And so, yeah, there are times I miss it. Yeah, absolutely.
The next question, we're almost at the end here now, but the next question is, I like the least, you know, the opposite of the previous one.
Right-wing politicians.
Yeah, all of them?
Every one of them, every one of them to their cursed little bone marrows.
You're not joking, are you?
No, I'm not joking. It's not that I don't like the least, I hate them.
Right. But is that including going on, I mean, from Nixon to Reagan or just present day right-wing politicians?
Hey, listen, Reagan couldn't get nominated in today's Republican Party. He'd be too far to the left.
Yeah. So it means you're talking about the present.
I'm talking about the present lot of mewling baboons. Yes.
What happened? You know? Do you know?
I don't know if it was some sort of bacteria that floated through the air that was just, you know, in the filtration systems of Republican conventions or what. But they are insane cowards. And I loathe them.
Have you ever met one of them, you know, personally?
No.
Would you like to?
Listen, I know some conservatives. Yeah. You know, I've sat down with conservative columnists. I have nothing against conservatives, by the way. I think that there's some legitimate arguments to be had between sort of liberalism and conservatism on several issues. But I hate this neo-fascist gang, you know. No, I have no desire to meet them. What? Why?
And persuade them to, you know, see.
You can't talk to these people, man. Come on. You know, you can't talk to some woman who thinks that President Biden is Nicolas Cage in a mask. You can't talk to people who think there's a child sex trafficking ring in the basement of a pizza restaurant that has no basement. What are you supposed to say to those people?
Wake up or...
Yeah, you can't. You can't have a conversation with you. You have to defeat them. There's nothing to be said anymore. We talk to the undecideds. You talk to the undecideds. Right. Absolutely.
That's where the battle is, you know.
That's where the battle is. But to those hardcore... Sorry, I have to cough. I apologize.
Sure, no problem.
I don't want to meet them. I meet too many of them. You know, sometimes they stop me on the road. I'm out for a walk.
Okay.
You know, and some pickup truck will pull up and they yell at me, you know, and that kind of stuff.
What do they yell?
We hate what you write on Twitter.
Okay.
I say, well, don't read it, you know. There's a simple solution to that.
But that's as far as they go. They don't do anything more than yell?
I get threats. Yeah, I get threats.
Does that mean to your life?
Yeah.
Okay. What do that do to you?
Yeah, I guess you can't see me shrug over the audio. Not much. Listen, most of these people are physical as well as moral cowards.
Yeah,
I'm not afraid of them.
Okay.
I've had to take certain precautions. I think we just kind of went through one of them.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, but other than that, I don't do much about it.
Do you think, by the way, Trump is coming back as a president?
Yes.
I mean? You think so?
Well, as a president, I hope not. Jesus God. As a candidate, yes.
He'll try to run. Do you think he'll be elected the candidate for the Republicans?
If he wants it, I think he has it. Look, he has a $100 million war chest he's sitting on.
Okay. And is that sort of the, you know, end game preventing him from becoming a president? Is it too late if he does, or
Well, listen, it's yeah, certainly the goal is to prevent him or one of his imitators mm-hmm. from becoming president. You know, if it's not him, God knows he's got enough people imitating him, you know, none of them would be any good either, obviously.
Do you sleep well at night?
I have a wicked insomnia problem, actually.
Oh.
But it's not that I don't sleep because I'm worried about politics okay. and things. I think it's just
that.
No. Yeah, I think it's you know, your mind just gets busy, doesn't it? You know, we'll see now that I'm retiring. You know, because a lot of that was like thinking about plots and characters, yeah. and characters are talking to you and all of that kind of thing. So, you know, I finished this last book like 2 days before I went on tour. Which has been okay. going on now for, you know, over a month. And so I don't know yet what retirement feels like, you know, because I'm doing this all the time.
Twitter stuff going on in your mind.
Yeah, probably. Yeah, sometimes that, absolutely. Last night, you know, yeah.
Last night, okay, yeah, of course. Okay, last question here, Dan, is what I would like to be for the kids, you know, when they grow up. And yes, you already, you know, just changed your career to becoming a warrior on the path for freedom or the truth. Is there anything else you'd like to, you know, become?
No, I've become it. You know, yeah. it's amazing to me, you know, that dream was fulfilled. You know, I always wanted to do this. I always wanted to write novels and I got to do it. You know, and had, you know, some measure of success at it. So, dream realized.
Check on the box.
Yeah. Which is pretty cool, you know.
It is.
Yeah, it took a while.
You know, I really get sad when I think about you retiring from writing because I love your books. And I just don't say that because you're my guest, because I really love reading your
appreciate
stuff.
Appreciate that. Well, there'll be two more coming. You know, it's a long goodbye.
Yeah. And I, you know, still have a hope that you might change your mind. You don't have to answer.
Okay, I won't answer. Thank you.
All right.
Yeah.
Anyway, you know that you have this one guy in Norway.
That's good to know. Yeah. Good to know, man. Thank you. Yeah. I appreciate that. Yeah.
Very good talking to you, Dan. Have the best of luck to the rest of your tour and everything else going on, especially the next chapter of your life.
I appreciate that. Thank you very much. This has been fun. Thanks for having me.
Bye.
Bye.
Moderne media.
Kan kundene dine betale slik de ønsker? Med betalingsløsninger fra Svea øker du sannsynligheten for at kundene fullfører et kjøp, fordi de finner sitt foretrukne betalingsvalg. Svea. Vår jobb. Din betalingsløsning. Enklere. Raskere.